Counsels of Perfection for Christian Mothers by Lejeune, Part 2nd, The Means, Chapter 1, Spiritual Reading. No doubt you are aware, my daughters, that your personal wardrobe, let me say, of ideas and sentiments is not very extensive, and that unless you renew it frequently, it will soon be exhausted. Left to yourselves, you will always revolve in the same plane, think the same thoughts, and perhaps never find a new habiliment in which to dress them. Therefore, you must frequently renew your wardrobe of ideas. Someone must whisper new sentiments into your ears each day. Now, spiritual reading can render you this service. The author of the pious work which you will read plays the part of a very rich friend who opens up his treasures and shares them with you. You will enrich yourself then with the spirit of the saints. You will absorb their sentiments. You will be benefited by the fruits of their experience. It is useless to insist further on the advantages of spiritual reading. You already sufficiently appreciate, I hope, the immense advantage which your natural poverty will find in this participation in the riches and wealth of the saints. To my mind, the best and the least fatiguing of preachers is a good book. It is not importunate when you leave it. You may return to it when you wish. It is not indiscreet, since it gives advice without knowing whether or not it will be followed. It is not susceptible to jealousy, since it accords you the liberty to reject its counsels or to prefer those of another. It would be a grave error to believe that the preaching of a good book is intended only for those specially consecrated to God. When we exhort certain persons to do some spiritual reading every day, they look at us with astonishment and exclaim, "Do you advise spiritual reading for me, the mother of a family who has to live in a whirlwind of duties in the midst of the world? This advice would be good for a religious or for those who live in the solitude of the cloister." This objection is by no means new. St. John Chrysostom in his day answered it as follows, "What do you say? The reading of these good books does not concern you? But I find this duty more incumbent on you than on those living in the security of the cloister. For you who sail on the open sea, whether you will it or not, are beset by a thousand occasions of sin. Thus, the aid of spiritual books is for you a necessity. A religious can't be wounded, because she is far from the combat, but you who are in the middle of battle must protect yourself with the buckler of holy thoughts drawn from good books." Meditate also, my daughters, on these lines which St. Francis de Sales wrote to Madame Brulart, an accomplished woman of the world. "I wish that you would not permit a day to pass without giving an hour or half an hour to the reading of some spiritual book." And in another letter to the same lady he says, "Read as often as you can, but only a little at a time, and above all, read with devotion." In his Introduction to the Devout Life, the saint completes this counsel. "Have always before you some good and pious book, and read a little in it each day with devotion, as if you were reading letters which the saints had sent you from heaven, to show you the way and encourage you to follow it." Why have the saints so highly extolled the advantages of spiritual reading? Why have they exalted it almost to the level with prayer? Without doubt they were guided by the reasons which I have placed before you, but they were influenced also by another motive, one that seems of capital importance to me. It arises from the fact that spiritual reading is one of the principal sources whence we draw light. Have you ever reflected, my daughters, how important light is for us in our relations with God? From certain maxims or passages taken at random from spiritual writers, it would seem that mortification and sacrifice are the sole means of approaching nearer to God. Thus the author of The Imitation exalts reaction against our evil inclinations. He declares that the success of our struggle against nature is always the measure of our progress towards perfection. Certainly this principle is true, and it would be ill become us to complacently modify it. On the other hand, we must remember that energy is sacrifice. In sacrifice is dependent upon clear-sightedness. We are energetic in sacrifice only when we see clearly the object of that sacrifice. It is the office of the intelligence to point out the path to the will. The will itself would remain inert if motives of action and sacrifice did not stimulate it. A strong and vigorous will is always accompanied by an enlightened intelligence. Must we not conclude, then, that a solid knowledge of the principles of the spiritual life is a potent aid to the soul in its striving toward good? Hence, we must appreciate the value of spiritual reading, since it furnishes us with the principles of the science of the saints, as well as with the practical counsels and precious examples. To be sure, God can, when he so wishes, dispense with every intermediary, and become himself the teacher of those simple and pious persons who lack intellectual culture. We have seen this in the case of that poor menial who could neither read nor write. We've learned of his great and heroic sanctity. In this case, books of piety will not bring about those marvelous results. Shall we say that this mediocre mind did not receive light from on high? No, 1,000 times no. Light was directly shed upon that mind by God. And why? Because it could not be enlightened save by that means. But if you, my daughters, hope that God will employ a similar means in your regard, you will have to wait a very long time. God has given you the means to instruct yourselves in spiritual science, and you are bound to use those means. Now, if the reading of pious books is one of these means, you are bound, in conscience, to read them. Under pain of allowing our spiritual life to run wild, we are obliged to develop the intelligence as much as possible. Why be astonished, then, that the lives of so many persons are sterile? If they do not make progress in the spiritual life, it is due to the fact that their minds are not enlightened and that their intellectual vision is defective. And what will rectify this defective vision? The words of a master drawn from spiritual reading. Take, for example, two persons equally endowed with intelligence. One has been in contact with the best authors through spiritual reading, while the others have always been content with her own resources. I hold that the former would travel very much farther than the latter on the road to sanctity. I pause to answer an objection which I have frequently met with from those who do not practice spiritual reading. Do you engage in spiritual reading every day, I have asked, and they have responded, No, I have no time. Well, for mothers of families who toil from morning till night to gain a livelihood, this reason is acceptable. But when it is alleged as an excuse for the laziness and inertia of those who squander a considerable amount of time in useless babbling, in long and purposeless visits, and in reading the daily papers, this excuse is intolerable. How many are there among you, my daughters, who cannot reserve at least a quarter of an hour every day for spiritual reading, by omitting all futile occupations and by economizing their time? There are some, perhaps, but not very many, I know. Chapter 2, Spiritual Reading, How to Engage in It. In the preceding chapter, I have pleaded the cause of spiritual reading and pointed out the immense advantages occurring from such exercise. It is now my intention to give you some practical counsels on the manner of doing it profitably. Before opening a book, it is well to ask God in a short prayer to grant that your reading may be profitable both to the mind and to the heart. Lord, open my mind to thy word. Grant that I may understand it, relish it, and put it into practice. In these terms does St. Ephrem exhort us to address God before we begin to read. I advise you to repeat these words, my daughters. Perhaps you've read and reread some passage in a spiritual work without ever understanding it. At least you have never penetrated into its depths, nor grasped its hidden meaning and practical consequences. And why? Has the author written in enigmas? Has his words lacked clarity? Not at all. His thought is always perfectly expressed. If you have reaped no benefit from your reading, it is due to the fact that you have read without light from above. Without that light which is absolutely necessary to give you a knowledge of the things of God. The proof of this assertion lies in the fact that rereading this same passage today, you receive a sudden illumination. Your minds are flooded with light, and things are revealed to you of whose existence you did not dream. What then is the conclusion to be drawn, if not that left to yourselves you would walk in darkness, without knowledge of the truths of your holy religion? Poor blind people that we are, how needful it is for us, before opening a book of piety, to supplicate the Holy Spirit to reveal to us its true sense by enlightening our minds on those parts which seem obscure. Some read solely with their minds. They treat the science of God as a human science. Their one aim is to satisfy their need of knowledge and instruction. If you, my daughters, should attempt spiritual reading with this end in view, it would be just as well, I must avow, to lay down your book. You would only waste your time. The author of The Imitation tells us that there are two kinds of knowledge. One resides solely in the mind. It is cold and sterile. The other resides in the heart, and having partaken of its warmth, is warm itself and luminous. It is this latter knowledge, impelling us to action, self-reform, and the practice of good deeds, that we must have in view when making our spiritual reading. I will read so as to learn the means for becoming better. I will seek light for my mind, and yet more for my will. In one word, I will strive to know God better so that I may love Him better. Such are the intentions we should form before opening a book of piety. Let us follow the advice which St. John the Baptist de la Salle gives us. Read your book, he says, as you would read a letter which Jesus Christ has sent you to make known His will and what He expected of you. Read slowly and seriously. Take time to assimilate the thoughts of the author. These are precious counsels given us by the saints. Now there are some people who take it upon themselves in all seriousness to read a certain number of chapters each day. These people conscientiously perform their task to the very last word. Whether their book of piety is easy to understand or exacts a great amount of meditation, it is all the same to them. They have bound themselves to read just so many chapters daily. I'm curious to know just how much could sink into the mind of a person who would thus swallow whole a chapter of The Imitation. Maxims such as those contained in this work must be dwelt upon in serious meditation, if we wish them to sink into the mind and be relished by the heart. When I see a reader gulping down, let me say, the maxims on The Imitation, I am not at all fearful that she is expending too much cerebral effort. The poor woman has read, but she has not thought. Despite myself, I am strongly reminded of this axiom in medicine. It is not what we eat, but what we digest that nourishes. My daughters, you must learn how to digest your reading. Now this digestion, this assimilation of the thoughts of others, is impossible without reflection. By this I mean that you should reread a passage several times if need be, and repeat it to yourselves until you are positive that you have grasped the thought of the authors. A spiritual book cannot be read like a novel. It requires serious meditation, since it is not a mere amusement for the mind. These practical counsels would be incomplete did I not exhort you to propose to yourselves a few important questions in the course of your spiritual reading. As the various truths stretch out before you, ask yourselves what your convictions are and how you stand from the viewpoint of practice. Compare your conduct with the maxims inculcated by the author and determine the method you will adopt in reforming your lives. Chapter 3, Spiritual Reading, What Books to Read. I fancy that I can hear several of my readers proposing this question. Having resolved henceforth to do some spiritual reading, we desire to know what books you would advise us to read. The question is certainly practical, and, moreover, attests on the part of those who advance it a certain goodwill which affords me great joy. But I must avow that I am at a loss just what to answer. I have assuredly come to the most arduous part of my task. How many questions must be answered and how many obscurities cleared away before it may be said to anyone, from a knowledge of the cause, this is the book suitable for you. The moral temperament of a person, her particular needs, the duties incumbent upon her, the time at her disposal, the degree of spirituality which she has attained, all these facts must be taken into consideration. Therefore, on account of the difficulties which this problem involves, I shall attempt to take refuge in this response. In the matter of spiritual reading, we must consult our conscience, especially in case of doubt. In this work, destined as it is to be read by persons of all degrees of spirituality, filled with various aspirations and pursuing paths diametrically opposed to each other, The most I can do is to fix a few landmarks, so to speak, and to give only general directions. The Gospel is entitled to a special place in preference to all other books. It ought to be in every family. You should never permit a day to pass without reading at least a page of it. It is humiliating to think that Protestants must be proposed as models for you in this matter. The four Gospels are within the reach of even the poorest. They are the best reading for you and your family. When a person is sure not to obtain very much, he is usually modest in his demands. If I must deal with a person who submits with a grimace to spiritual reading, and to whom it is almost necessary to do violence to have her give a quarter of an hour a day to God, I shall be careful not to advise a book of strong spirituality. She would invariably abandon her reading after a few attempts, or her continual yawns would give an excellent idea of the fruit which her reading produces. A strong viand supplies much more nourishment to a weak stomach than is useful. My advice to such a one is to read the life of some saint, wherein the charming style, the interest of the narrative, and the profundity of the psychological analysis take the edge off the lessons of austerity. Monsignor Bourgond and Monsignor Lagrange are masters in this art. A work bearing the signature of either of these two men may always be placed in the hands of a beginner, with the certitude that the reader will be captivated as well as edified. To one who is susceptible to emotion, and who can grow enthusiastic over noble causes, I should advise the life of Père Lacordaire by Père Coquarin, or the biography of Henri Préreve by Père Grotry. Acquaintance with these heroic and sympathetic men will make us better, detach us from the thousand vanities in which we are centered, and elevate us to those heights on which these great Christians have led their lives. There is one book whose privilege it is to speak as a friend to anyone who wishes to consult it, a book which has remedies for all the wounds of the soul, consolations for every trial, and rules of life for all imaginable situations. It is the book for the layman as well as for the religious, for the woman of the world as well as for the recluse, for the beginner who struggles against his passions as well as for the saint confirmed in virtue. I refer to the Imitation of Christ. This book, says Fontenelle, the best that has come from the hand of man since the Gospel, would not go straight to the heart, as it does, nor seize it with so much force, if it had not that natural and tender address to which even negligence of style adds very much. The author of The Imitation is not a friend who has pruned his words. His language has not had that affectedness which ordinarily characterizes human attempts at consolation. It is somewhat rude, nay, rough at times, but what a tender, delicate, and disinterested soul is found under this roughness. I distrust the praises which unbelievers bestow upon The Imitation. Their admiration appears entirely conventional to me. What can those chapters which treat solely of self-renouncement mean to him who has not the faith? What meaning is there for him in such chapters as The Royal Road of the Holy Cross, or The Love of Jesus Above All Things? One must be a practical Christian to understand something of these theories which reverse the human order of things and upset all worldly ideas. Let me add that in order to penetrate this book to its very depths, to understand the hidden sense of many expressions, and to grasp all those truths which the author has left understood, one must have lived the same interior life as he lived, and be familiar with the loftiest questions of spirituality. My daughters make the experiment. Reread The Imitation after a retreat or a mission. It will appear entirely new to you, and you will be forced to confess that up to this day you have not understood it. A great number of spiritual works center around The Imitation. Limited as I am to one chapter, I must be content with a dry enumeration. The Spiritual Combat by Scopolis, which is said to be The Imitation reduced to practice. The Introduction to a Devout Life by St. Francis de Sales. Christian Perfection by Rodriguez. This is a work of classic merit. It is not only in a seminary or religious community that it should serve as current reading. It is a little dry, but replete with doctrine. The Practice of Love Towards Jesus Christ by St. Alphonsus Liguori. This is a delightful work, very easy to read. The Various Works of Pierre Sanjour. Meditations on the Holy Ghost by Pergmeyer. The Way of Interior Peace by Père de Lehen. The Manual of Interior Souls, The School of Jesus Christ, The Interior Life of Jesus and Mary by Père Gru. Retreats by Père Olivant. I know my readers are surprised that the foregoing list contains the name of no contemporaneous writer, but I could not cite some without slighting others, a thing which would grieve me deeply. I have confined myself to the classics, so to speak, which constitute the foundation of all spiritual writings. If I have made no mention of the works of exalted spirituality, for example, the works of St. Teresa or St. John of the Cross, it is not because I am hostile to this kind of reading. I have excellent reasons for omitting them. In the first place, the imagination of women is too sensitive to the extraordinary phenomena recorded in these works. In other words, women are too susceptible to what is known in medicine as auto-suggestion. Moreover, these writings contain terms which are incomprehensible to her who has not the key to the mystic language. Therefore, it would be almost a waste of time to read St. Teresa or St. John of the Cross in the absence of this essential. The reading of a mystic work, then, should be undertaken only on the advice of an enlightened director. Chapter 4, Meditation. I know that the title of this chapter will not evoke the sympathy of all my readers. I fancy that I can hear certain ones among them crying out, "Meditation? Have you reflected well, rash author, on what you ask of us? Do not forget that you are writing for mothers of families who are continually busy and who, for this reason, are little acquainted with the high practices of the spiritual life. The most you should have asked of us is to do some spiritual reading each day. Now you are adding meditation? This is too much. Do not waste your ink. Reserve your good counsels for the chosen few who have more time than we." You are mistaken, my daughters. I advise meditation for you who are tainted by indifference, for you who are as yet lukewarm. Yes, I would induce you to make a meditation every day. To begin with, I hold that meditation is not at all difficult for you. Again you cry out, "How can you say that? I have tried it many times and have never succeeded." This argument has no effect on me. Your experiment has been badly made with a bad instrument, a book which was not suitable for you, I fancy. You must try again. Many among you, my daughters, have decided that you cannot make meditation. We shall see if you do not soon change your minds. I know that you feel no attraction for this exercise. It would surprise me if you did. Your attempts to meditate have been so weak that they can furnish no conclusion whatsoever. If one of your children, before placing his fingers on the keyboard, would tell you that he is utterly unable to play the piano, his affirmation would not convince you. You would demand a serious attempt from him. I have the right to demand the same from you when you say that meditation is beyond your power. I have the right to exact from you a loyal and serious attempt, and if you give me this satisfaction, the cause is won. Your prejudice against this exercise will soon disappear. If meditation required great intellectual effort, or a passionate expression of your love of God, I could understand your dislike for it. But in the face of a true and genuine concept of it, all those pretexts which are trumped up by lukewarmness and pusillanimity disappear. What is meditation if not a centering of the mind on one especial subject for the purpose of perceiving it in all its diverse forms, and a dwelling upon the motives which can arouse in us the sentiments of love, hatred, desire, or regret? We meditate daily on the means to realize some worldly end or on the success of an enterprise which we have undertaken. We then set in motion all the forces of the soul. We bury ourselves in profound reflection, to such an extent that we are oblivious to all exterior noise. Were we to reflect on the things of God and the affairs of our soul as we reflect on the things of the natural order, Should we be incapable of meditation? An eminent cardinal affirms that no one has the right to say that he or she is incapable of meditation. There is no man, he writes, however ignorant, who cannot fix his thought on a grave manner, weigh the advantages or disadvantages resulting from it, and reflect on the means of securing the advantages or avoiding the disadvantages. Will it be very difficult then for him to think of his last end and to consider how much hell is to be feared and heaven desired? He can well recall the service of some benefactor who took upon his own shoulders the weight of his debts. Will it be very hard for him then to conjure up in his mind the image of the crucified Savior? He does not find it beyond his power to express his gratitude for a benefit received. Will it be hard for him then to express his love for God? But reflecting in this way and expressing this various sentiments is nothing else than meditation. Take care, my daughters, not to fall into an error that is common in our day. The efficacy of prayer is too often estimated by the sum of emotions or sensations which it produces. When the movement of the blood grows rapid and the play of the imagination becomes more facile and agreeable, it is supposed by many that the end of a prayer is obtained, and it is not possible to pray better. But if, unfortunately, the organs of sense refuse to partake of the feast, then all is lost. Prayer has lost its wings and soars upward no more. Through obedience or complacence, the attempt to pray is repeated for a few days. Then, with this decision, I cannot pray, the whole affair is definitely settled. This presumption is not new, since Rodriguez has already dealt with it, but it is found singularly reinforced in our epoch by the exigencies of an almost sickly sensibility with which directors of souls have to contend. Thus, in the face of all the ideas current around them, they must strongly insist in their dealings with souls on the end and purpose of prayer, and recall that its aim is not at all to administer to our organs of sense, but to determine the will to action. The wise counsels of Rodriguez on this subject are very precious. It must frequently be recalled, he writes, that the merit and fruit of prayer do not consist in arousing sentiments which produce a certain sweetness and sensible consolation. It is not necessary for you to experience these emotions. It suffices for you to desire them with a firm and determined will. When it pleases God to send you these sentiments, receive them with gratitude, but do not be grieved by their absence. God does not ask them from you. He requires only what is in your power. To love God in prayer with a firm will is the true and solid love that He demands of you. This other love is a tender love that does not depend on you. Make a good choice of your books for meditation. A book adapted to your needs will always facilitate meditation. Now in this book, pass over the chapters which do not appear practical for you, or the reading of which is repugnant or onerous. This exercise should not deteriorate into drudgery. The idea is that meditation, while very serious in itself, should also be attractive. Leave aside, then, those authors whose spirituality seems dry to you, and whose piety is narrow and harsh. Adapt, rather, those authors who inspire confidence and lead you to God and love. Do you desire another counsel? Adopt from preference a book that takes for its theme the life of Jesus. Some authors propose to their readers subjects which are intended more for examination of conscience than for arousing piety. This is wrong. Humility, for example, will appear much more attractive if we contemplate it in the objections of the incarnate Word than if it be shown us in catalogue form with divisions and subdivisions. You will tell me that a page of the Gospel is a sufficient theme for your daily meditation. I am overjoyed to hear you say this, and let me advise you to seek no other book than this one. Moreover, do not imagine that you must confine yourself strictly to what you have read. Go out from your subject and speak with God concerning your actual needs. Expose to Him your fears, your trials, and your hopes. In one word, make use of a holy liberty in this conversation with God. Your prayer, writes Fenelon, is efficacious only when you are at ease with God, your best friend in this world. Now let each and every one among you, my daughters, decide for herself whether meditation, such as I have just described it, is an exercise filled with difficulties and for the use of the perfect only, or whether the ease with which it can be made does not place it in the hands of all, even the lukewarm. Someone has said that the best method of prayer is that which each one has found best for himself. Thus let me advise those of my readers who make use of any other method of prayer to hold to the one whose advantages they have experienced. The rules that I here lay down are intended for those who have not as yet adopted a method, or who are not satisfied with the method they have followed up to this time. Read on the evening before the subject which you have chosen for the next day. Foresee in a general way the thoughts on which you will pause from preference, and the sentiments which you will most easily arouse. Retire with the subject of your meditation in your mind, and recall it in the morning while dressing. Prayer calls for three preparatory acts. Adore God, present around you and in you, or better yet, go straight to the heart of Jesus, present in the tabernacle, and adore him in silence. Second, ask pardon for your faults. What purity does not intimacy with Jesus demand? Ask pardon for your hidden faults. Blot out my iniquities. Ask pardon again for the faults already pardoned. Wash me yet more from my iniquities. 3. Ask from the Holy Ghost the gift of prayer. Lord, teach me to pray. Grant me the gift of prayer. Give me a relish for prayer, so that it may be easy for me to pray. The body of the prayer. The body of the prayer is composed of four parts. 1. Reflection. 2. Acts or affections. 3. Petitions. 4. Resolutions. First, reflection. Recall to mind the subject you have chosen. If you have already meditated often on the subject, you are well convinced of the truths in question. Or if you know all the principal parts of the mystery on which you will meditate, a simple recollection will suffice, and you will pass immediately to the acts. If, on the contrary, your convictions are not deeply rooted, or if you have never penetrated into the depths of the mystery, you may draw up in your minds the reasons that lead to conviction, or circumstances that will throw light on the mystery. It is the intelligence that acts in this case, but permit it only to act in so far as is necessary. Prayer is not a speculation, nor an intellectual game. It is an affectionate conversation with God for the purpose of becoming better. Do not permit the intelligence to act, then save when it is necessary to arouse the acts or affections. 2. The acts or affections. You will have a choice of various acts, but remember that in so short a time it will be impossible to produce them all. If only one suffices, confine yourselves to it, that is, faith, confidence, desire, contrition, firm purpose of amendment, and the most important of all, the act of love. You must tell God that you love him above all things. This act must result from and terminate every meditation without exception. Apply the insufficiencies of your love, appeal to the ardent love of the heart of Jesus. An important observation. Do not be afraid to repeat the same sentiments to our divine Lord over and over again. You will never tire any one by repeating frequently that you love him, and that you desire to avoid whatever displeases him. 3. Petition. This point merits a separate place in our prayer. Never make a prayer without a petition. Be always a mendicant before God. Moreover, ask with the heart of Jesus and by the heart of Jesus. And ask what? A. Grace to correspond to the subject meditating upon. B. Other graces for all that concerns you from a natural and a supernatural standpoint. C. An ever-increasing love for the Sacred Heart. D. Heaven. E. The conversion of sinners and the reign of the Sacred Heart over all the earth. 4. Resolutions. These should be very precise and of such a kind that they may be put into practice that very day. It is a good idea always to renew some particular resolution. It is also well to take some particular resolution that is suggested by the subject or adapted to certain circumstances which you foresee will occur during the day. Finally, place all your resolutions and the fruit of your prayer under the guidance of the Sacred Heart of Jesus. Chapter 5. Good Resolutions. In the preceding chapter we have said that good resolutions ought to follow our prayers. My daughters, do you know what a resolution is? Do you not often confound it with a simple desire? For example, you may have a wish to visit some friend who lives many miles away, but the difficulties of the journey prevent your undertaking it, and you postpone the project to some later day. Relative to the journey, you entertain only a simple desire. When will you have formed a resolution? When you have determined to make the journey, when you have said, I am going to visit that friend, and I shall set out on such and such a day. A resolution, then, is an act of the will demanding execution at an opportune moment. While a desire is only a dream which is cherished with more or less complacence but never leads to action. A short analysis will suffice to show you that the resolution is one of the principal elements of spiritual progress. You make progress only insofar as you sincerely and firmly wish for progress. Even when you will have formed a grand ideal of a truly Christian life, even when through meditation you will have great zeal for good and for virtue, yes, even then I shall be rather uncertain as to whether your efforts will have been useless and your time wasted. You have so many desires which remain inefficacious, so many aspirations which remain sterile. Therefore, I shall not be certain that you are in earnest until I hear you say, I will make progress despite all obstacles and every barrier. Have you not here before your eyes the cause of your failure in the spiritual life? You have taken the mere desire of virtue for virtue itself, and because you have felt lifted up by emotion in prayer, you have believed that the end was attained. You have believed that your ideal of the truly Christian life was fully realized. However, at the first temptation you fell miserably, and perceived that your love of God, which you thought was eternal, was only a sudden blaze. Remember well, my daughters, that the saints are saints only because they were men and women of strong and vigorous will. So few of us today know how to use the will. Does this not explain why the standard of sanctity has fallen so low? The generality of men are affected by a malady of the will. Because this faculty does not guide the helm, they go on at random and become the sport of the winds of caprice. By reason of this vacillating state, they are as incapable of great good as they are of great evil. I must denounce this malady of the will so as to fortify you against it and incite you to combat it, both in yourselves and your children. Teach your children from their earlier years how to will manfully and how to make resolutions which are not mere velleities. Make them put their resolutions into practice as soon as they have made them. Remember, my daughters, that God of Himself cannot construct our edifice of perfection. He has absolute need of our cooperation. The cooperation of our will. Yes, we must place as a cornerstone to that edifice an energetic I will. Without that, all the solicitations of divine grace are vain. They are choked by the inertia of the will. We are bound, then, to cooperate with God. And in what does our cooperation consist, if not in the resolution to cooperate with His grace? My daughters, let me propose a question which I know will take you unawares. However, you must make a truthful answer. Have you made a good resolution today? Did you say this morning, in the course of this day I am going to mortify myself in such and such a manner. I intend to offer to God this or that thing which demands sacrifice of me. I shall strive to fulfill this or that duty to the best of my ability. O happy days in which you have made resolutions such as these, and how barren the day in which you have not done so. Perhaps some of you are among the number of the discouraged, who, because of their infidelity to resolutions taken 100 times, fear to be disloyal again, and so do not dare to promise God anything. Struggle against this discouragement. Form once again those same resolutions which you have broken so many times. Form them with a humble distrust in yourself, but with a boundless confidence in God. You who make a meditation every morning and have the happiness communicate frequently, remember that each one of these great acts of your spiritual life entails very specific resolutions. Because they have lacked this necessary crown, your prayers and meditations have often been fruitless. Let me say a few words now on the qualities of a good resolution. To begin with, a resolution should be precise. How can you resolve unless you have a clear concept of the end for which you resolve? You will only waste your time if you make resolutions such as, I wish to do better. I desire to correct my faults. I would like to acquire the virtues which are dear to the heart of Jesus, etc. These resolutions remind me of the story of the woman who wanted to visit Paris. This woman used to say frequently, I would like to visit Paris very much. However, as the story goes, she took no means to carry out her desire. Though she entertained this desire for 20 years, it never brought her to Paris. Now, if a person really wishes to go to Paris, she will evidently decide on the day of departure, the mode of travel, and the course to take. This is the same as saying, he who wills the end wills the means. If you really desired to correct your faults, you would not make such vague resolutions. You would seek out the means that tend towards the end in view, and when you had discovered the road, you would say, I must take that road. Your resolutions must be practical. You know from experience that long-dated resolutions amount to nothing. I might even add that they betray a disloyalty on the part of those who make them. I desire to reform, but I shall begin in a week from now. It would be so much better to say, I do not wish to reform at all. This would be harsh indeed, but true. Sincere resolutions ought to be put into practice not in a week from now, not tomorrow, but this very day. If not, they are useless. Your resolutions ought to be constant, to vacillate, to jump from one resolution to another. To undertake the reform of one fault today and give your attention to another fault tomorrow means certain failure. You will attain serious and lasting results in the spiritual life only by directing your forces toward one end. Dispersion of the energies engenders a fatal sterility. Recall to mind the words of the Imitation. If you succeed in overcoming one fault each year, you will soon be a perfect man. Do not hesitate, then, to dwell for a long time on the same field of action and to take the same resolutions daily, varying them according to circumstances. Force yourselves never to begin a day without making one or more good resolutions. Then give your resolutions a precise form. Finally, determine that particular fault on which your efforts must be centered until they have attained a decisive result. Chapter 6, Examination of Conscience. My daughters, weigh well these words of an esteemed ascetic writer. We cannot pretend to honesty in the perfect life if we do not practice examination of conscience with exactness. We can indeed be very imperfect and not be aware of it unless we are guided by a rule. On the contrary, as soon as we adopt a rule, we can easily perceive our defects. Now, in the examination of conscience, we employ a rule by which we scrutinize our actions so as to discover whether they approach near or fall short of the straight path of duty. An artisan must always have his rule in his hand if he aims at producing a masterpiece. This is even more incumbent on the spiritual artisan if he aims at producing a masterpiece in the supernatural order. When we clean a room, we gather up all the dust and dirt and then sweep it out. We should clean our spiritual room in the same way. Examination of conscience gathers up all the faults, repentance sweeps them out. We must know our faults so as to gather them up in a heap, as it were, in the memory. Finally, this knowledge should enable us to confess them, combat them, and cleanse the soul from them. Alvarez de Paz. Continued on side 2 of this tape.